I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
It sounds good to me, Godfather. Go right on ahead and do it. Make the system an offer it can't refuse. Yeah. Terrible Tommy here. Tom Metzger. In the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where the flowers are growing, the hay is growing, the corn is growing, and we're all getting cornier than hell around here. Before I forget it, I think from now on, for a while anyhow, you know how changeable I am, we'll do a archive show on Saturday, and we'll do the live shows all week. That way I get the Saturday a little bit off and Sunday off and like that. Because I have a lot of other things to do around this place, you know, very important things. I mean, you know, earth-shattering things. And so we'll do that for a while and see what happens. Incidentally, our archive, radio archives are supposed to be open, free, of course, the first two or three weeks. Once we make a show, it will not be available for free. But we get a lot of requests to open it up. Got one from Poland yesterday. Please, Mr. Metzger, will you open up your archives? I'm learning English by listening to your radio shows. How about that? Yeah. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. I'll do that slowly. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And I hope you're getting our non-equal signs all over the place. Well, I'll tell you, that's the thing to do. We've got to have some symbol to gather, rally around the flag. Not the flag, but that, I guess that'll be our flag, the non-equal sign. Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Well, I had a little problem yesterday. I drove about 25 miles to this town where they had the garage sales. The whole town, everybody was involved. It was great. Beautiful little town, too. I hadn't roamed around it much, but it's just a lovely little all-white town with all the mothers out with their new babies in their transportable units pushing them around. Not one Negro did I see in the whole town. How about that? I didn't see any Mexicans either. I was saying to my gal, I think I might want to move down there, you know. That might be a better place than where I'm at now. But anyhow, the trip was pretty eventful. This morning, or when I got back, I decided to go into town to do something. And all of a sudden, I heard my transmission going out on my 1999 Dodge van. And once I hear that sound, it's all over. So I was able to limp back home and try to decide what I'm going to do, but it'll cost more than the van's worth to fix it up. At least $1,000. I ain't paying that kind of money because you know how cheap I am. But I did see a Jeep Cherokee sitting down the road for a sale. Looked pretty good. Four-wheel drive and everything like that. Like a tank. Boy, those are like a tank. I'll make him an offer. I make it a practice never to give over $1,000 for a vehicle. That probably makes you laugh because everybody, most people get credit and pay payments. I don't do that. I don't believe in that. So anyhow, I'm going to go on over there and say, hey, boy, here's the cash on the counter. Give me that Jeep and see what he says. I think I did pretty good on an old Dodge. I had it 4 or 5 years. No problems other than little teeny problems. Lasted that long. And I only paid the guy $1,000 for it. Yeah. So I'll roll it out here on the front lawn and put a $500 sale tag on it. And put that $500 towards the other one. Yeah. I'm sure you're not interested in all this crap. But since I like to talk to you, and I don't have too many people around town I sit around and talk to, because I don't talk about the price of pork and the price of eggs and the price of corn and all that kind of stuff, or the Christian churches around here, the mind control centers. So I'll talk to you because you're my buddies. Man, you never know what you're gonna hear on this damn show. Yeah, dude. Well, boys and girls, we can't go on forever with that. That collection of music there proves that Terrible Tommy's absolutely insane. We go from hillbilly racism to, I think, Russian violin music of some kind called Nitberg. Somebody sent me that a few years ago. Every once in a while I dig it out. Hey, you know, here's something, another little something that you probably never heard of, and that is the fact that 35 years ago, I don't know the exact date, but I was running my little television servicing shop in Fallbrook, California, and a little old couple came in. I had a business trailer where I did my work, and a little old couple came in there with their television for me to take care of, and we got to talking, and I found out their name was Yankovic. I said, no, then you're not going to tell me there's a connection. They said, yep, we're Weird Al Yankovic's parents that lived there in the area where I did. And they used to come in every once in a while. I'd say, how's Weird Al doing? They'd say, oh, you're doing pretty good. Yeah. The reason I remember that is because there was a bit on the radio this morning in the early hours where they were, Weird Al Yankovic was being interviewed and about his past and all his stuff. I understand he's the, what did he say? He's the associate editor or some kind of editor of Mad Magazine now. How about that? Well, let's get on with this shoe. Well, at least, you know, part of my job is offending people who offend me, and I'm offended by the black race all the time. They really do, because they just won't own up to their situation in the evolutionary chain, and sometimes we have to remind them, and I don't go out of my way to make them unhappy, but they seem to go out of their way to make me unhappy, I'm telling you. You got the mulatto nation. It's not really, I don't think it's really the real Negroes that make me unhappy, it's the mulatto nation, yeah. What about this Clinton guy? He got all this money made out of Haiti. He's made millions exploiting Haiti. Yeah, he said, I love those Negroes down there, and I go down there and help them out. But every time I help them out a little, they help me out a lot, baby. Okay, I've got a little pamphlet in my hand. You know, I've collected hundreds of pamphlets over the years. This was out of Hollywood, California. Yeah. And it's called Negro Inferiority. Oh, you're not going to tell me that Negro Inferiority. You're not going to tell me that. Yep. That's what this little book says. Let's read a little bit of this and see what's going on. The theory of the Hemetic origins of Negroes, Hottentots, Australians, and Papuans implies that four races out of seven have experienced degeneracy. The sweeping backward movement of the work of an all-wise and all-benefit Mother Nature is appalling to contemplate, and it's not surprising that the theorists have existed who could deny the inferiority of these races with the same naivete as any other indisputable fact of observation. Judging from intercourse with friends of the Negro, of the noisy and denunciatory stamp, I should think a large body of philanthropists must exist to maintain that it is mere lacking of opportunity which causes the Negro to seem inferior to the white man. Consider how, for 200 years, he has dwelt in bondage. See him work late and early, in all weathers, sheltered like stock, in enclosures too open for comfort or health, and subsisting on sides and potatoes from January or December. The laws have even made it a crime to teach him to read a newspaper or the Holy, Holy, Holy Bible. Think of the hardships which he has endured, and judge whether they are not sufficient to have crushed all intelligence and moral principle and manly spirit out of a human being, unquote. But my good friend, I was not proposing to discourse of the Negroes of the United States. I am thinking of Africa, the continental home of the Negro. Yet, since the American Negro is suggested allow me to inquire how far the Negro has... Wait a minute. Hold it. Hold it. Pause. Descended below his native condition by being brought into contact with the white American civilization. Has he been sheltered in a more storm-riddled hat or clothed in scantier attire or subsisted on a leaner diet? Or has he associated with more degraded savages or learned to practice a more superstitious worship or been deprived of a more cultivated society? The Negro, perhaps, is not in America what he would have been if left in his own mastery in the midst of civilized society. The condition of the northern Negro will settle this question. But has he not made more progress than his countrymen who were left behind? Can we appeal to the oppression of the American Negro as an apology for the condition of the Negro on the banks of the Senegal and the Congo? The Israelites were in the house of bondage 216 years, and it is not supposable that bondage in the rude infancy of the world and in the heathen Egypt was less depressing than the bondage during the last two centuries in a so-called Christian country. But were the Israelites ever reduced to the mental and moral condition of the Negro? The literature, law, and religion of the Mosaic period will supply the answer. This is giving the Hebrews a break here. You'll pardon me. That the Negro race is an inferior race, it shall show by an appeal to the anatomical, physiological, psychical, and the historical facts. I have already pointed out the salient characteristics of the Negro race. Let me advert to those which establish his inferiority. Capacity of the cranium is universally recognized as a criterion of psychic power. No fact is better established than the general relation of intellect to weight of the brain. Welker has shown that the brains of 26 men of high intellectual rank surpass the average weight by 14%. Of course, quality of the brain is an equally important factor, and hence not a few men with brains even below the average have distinguished themselves for scholarship and executive ability. The Noachites at the large possesses a mean capacity of 1,500 cubic centimeters. The capacity among the Mongoloids is 1,450 cubic centimeters. Among the Negroes, 1,360 cubic centimeters, and among the Australians, 1,275 cubic centimeters. They're talking about those, not the white people. Assuming 100 as the average capacity of the Australian skull, that of the Negro is 111.6, and that of the Teuton, 124.8. In respect to the cephalic index, or form of the skull in a horizontal projection, we find that all the lower races are docalentopelic. I butchered that one. That's a $2 word there. And all the higher races are mesiophalic or braxcephalic. The index, for instance, among the Noachites ranges from 75 to 83. Among the Mongoloids, 71 to 90. And among the Negroes, from 69 to 76. And among the Australians, from 71 to 71.5. That's those Negroes down there in Australia. The broadest Negro skull does not reach the average of the Germans, nor does that best of the Australian skull reach the average of the Negro. Mean relative breadth of the skull is found to be associated with executive ability. Among whites, the relative abundance of the crossheads, having permanently unclosed the longitudinal and transverse sutures at the top of the head, is 1 in 7. Among the Mongoloids, it is 1 in 13. Among Negroes, it's 1 in 52. This peculiarity is supposed by some to favor the prolonged development of the brain. In any event, it is most frequent in the highest races. The completer development of the osseous tissues in the Negro cranium is probably related to that density and thickness of ossification which enables the Negro, both male and female, to fight by means of butting and to support, see there you go, that's why they make good prize fighters, and to support hard objects and great weights on the top of their head. Like I've always told somebody, if you're going to get in a fight with the black guy, do not go for the head. He's weakest around the knees and the legs, and even the midsection. But standing there beating on his head is pretty much a waste of time. The amount of prognathism in another marked criterion of organic rank, one method of expressing this is by means of the auricular radii, unquote, or distances from the opening of the ear to the roots of the upper teeth and to other parts of the head. Among Europeans, the distance to the base of the upper incisors is 99, but among Negroes, it averages 114. On the contrary, the average distance to the top of the head is among Europeans 112, but among Negroes 110. The distance to the upper edge of the occipital bone is among Europeans 104, among Negroes 104. These measurements prove that the Negro professes more face, and particularly of jaws, and less brain above. Other measurements furnish a similar result, and show also that the development of the posterior brain in relation to the anterior is greater in the Negro. Prognathism is otherwise expressed by means of the facial angle, general slope of the face from the forehead to the jaws when compared to a horizontal plane. Among the Noachites, the facial line is nearest perpendicular, given an angle of 77 degrees to 81 degrees. Among the Negroes, it averages only 67 degrees. Among the Hottentots and Bushmen, 60 degrees, and among the Australians, 68 degrees. Among Negroes, the forearm is longer in proportion to the arm than is the case for the whites. The same is true of the anthropoid apes. The Negro's arm, when suspended by the side, reaches the knee pan. Within a distance which is only 4.38% of the whole length of the body. The white man's arm reaches the knee pan within a distance which is 7.5% of the whole length of the body. Now, that's another reason when you're boxing these guys or street fighting these guys, you got to watch their reach. A lot of them have a longer reach than you do. This length of arm is again the quadruminous characteristic. The Negro pelvis averages but 26.5 inches in circumference. That of the white race is 33 inches. In the Negro, it is more inclined, which is another quadrumous character. It is also more narrow and elongated, and this is Rolick and Weber have suggested corresponds to the, boy, there's a word I'm not even going to try. I present here views of the skeletons of a... We've got a problem here on this page. It was reprinted and it's smeared. We're going to skip that. The color of the Negro brain is darker than that of the white, and its density and texture are inferior. The convolutions are fewer and are more simple. And, as Gazes and others long ago pointed out, approximately those of the quadrumina, according to M. de Ceres, the brain of the Caucasian during the embryonic development presents in succession the conformation seen in the Negro, the Malay, the American, and the Caucasian. This statement rests on excellent authority, but I am not aware that it has been confirmed. Its significance is apparent in view of the established principle in psychology, physiology, and the embryonic characters in any vertebrate resembling the adult characters of other vertebrates lower in rank. Again, the retreating contour of the chin as compared with the European approximates the Negro to prehistoric jaw of La Nalette and to the chimpanzee and lower mammals. Finally, the slenderness of the Negro arms and legs is also quadruminous. This character is still more striking in the structure of Australians. And again, I'm not talking about white Australians. This individual, however, is exceptional in activity and capacity for prolonged and intense effort. The Negro is notably inferior. This point, however, has been sufficiently presented. Psychically, I have spoken of the Negro to considerable extent. In brief, he possesses a strong curiosity to gaze upon new sights, or even familiar ones. But it is the curiosity of the child. He has a feeble power of combining his perceptions and drawing conclusions. In abstract conceptions, he is still mere helpless. No American Negro has ever proved any original work in the mathematics and philosophy. The imaginative and aesthetic powers are simply dormant. Poetry, sculpture, painting owe most nothing to Negro genius. Quote, "Never yet," says President Jefferson, "could I find that a black has uttered a thought above the level of a plain narration. Never saw an elementary trait of painting or sculpture." In reference to this, Mr. James Parton says, quote, "We cannot fairly deny the facts give support to the opinions of an inherent mental inferiority. It is 90 years since Jefferson published his notes, and we cannot yet name one Negro of pure blood who has taken the first, the second, or the third, the tenth rank in business, politics, art, literature, scholarship, science, or philosophy." Now remember, the mulattoism enters into this too, because a lot of people go say, "Oh my God, this Negro is he's a genius." Well, he may be half white. To the present hour, the Negro has contributed nothing to the intellectual resources of man. If he turns Negro minstrel, he still imitates the white creators of that black art, and he has not composed one of the airs that have had popular success as Negro melodies. These statements require slight qualification. Phyllis Wheatley is said to have been a Negro poetess 100 years ago, but her poetry, Parton says, was very inferior. She's not mentioned in the Tyler's History of American Literature, which, however, ends for the present with 1765. I'm not informed respecting the purity of her racial character. Miss Edmondia Lewis is a sculptress of considerable merit, but I'm informed that she has the benefit of about 50% of Caucasian blood. It is also true that some of the more gifted Negroes possess a wonderful power of emotional eloquence, but I suspect that in all these cases, some infusion of Caucasian blood exists, as in the case of the highly respected Marshal of the District of Columbia and one or two colored members of Congress, and also only, only a few colored pulpit orators. Nevertheless, such qualifications do not invalidate the statement that pure African blood, even under the influence of Caucasian civilization, has never achieved Let's see if we can catch up here. These statements have been made in reference to the American-born Negro. It is more appropriate to turn our attention to the Negro in his native haunts. The physical aspect of many native Africans gives them, beyond question, a decidedly beastly look. And that's why I can't understand when people go to the zoo or just generally walking around and look at a large percentage of Negroes, especially the poor Negroes, and then tell me that you don't see a connection to the simian animal, apes and so forth. I mean, even if it had nothing to do with their intellect or anything else, you can't deny that's what they look like. But try saying that in polite company today. These Negroes, a lot of them look like they're part of the monkey family or the apes. See, when people will go crazy, they'll run out of the room, they'll gnash their teeth, they'll call the NAACP. I mean, oh, God. This has been remarked again and again, Professor Orr Wyman says, quote, "It cannot be denied, however wide the separation, that the Negro and the orangutan or the orang do afford the points where man and the brute, when the totality of their organization is considered, most nearly approach each other." Here is Cuvier's description of the Bachman woman, known as the Hottentot Venus, who died in Paris on 29 of December, 1815, and whose life-size figure I have examined in the Museum of Jardin des Plantes. Quote, "She had a way of pouting her lips," he says, "exactly like we have observed among the orangutan. Her movements have somewhat abrupt and fantastical about them, reminding one of those of the ape. Her lips were monstrously large, and probably her ass was too." What gets me nowadays, we're getting white women that got as big an ass as these nigger women. Jesus. "Her ear was like that of many apes, being small and tragus weak, and the external border almost obliterated behind. These," he says, after having described the bones of the skeleton, "are animal characteristics. Again, I have never seen a human head more like an ape than that of this woman." In reference to the fatty protuberance of the haunches, that's the butt, he says, "They offer a striking resemblance to those which exist in the females of the mandrills, the papillons, and so on, which assume a certain epoch of their life, an enlargement truly monstrous." Well, he recognized the big asses way back then. And yet Cuvier was the champion of the opposers of Lamarck, who thought that he saw, that was the Russian eugenicist, Lamarck, who thought he saw a genetic as well as a physiognomic and osteologic relationship between the woman and the quadruma. Here again is Topinard's description of the Hottentot physiognomy. Quote, "The nose is frightfully broad and flat. The nostrils are thick, every divergent and exposed. Their prognathism is generally enormous, though it varies. The mouth is large, with thick, protruding, and turned-up lips." Just think, some of these Hollywood women and other women, they go out now and get their lips full of Botox, is it? So they can have lips look like nigger lips. Talk about insanity. The following is Lichtenstein's description of a Bozeman or a Bushman. Quote, "One of our present guests, who appear about 50 years of age, who had gray hair and bristly beard, whose forehead, nose, and cheeks and chin were all smeared with black grease, have only a white circle around the eye, washed clean with the tears occasioned by smoking. This man had the true physiognomy of a small blue ape of Caffraria. What gave the more verity to such a comparison was the vivacity of his eyes and the flexibility of his eyebrows, which he worked up and down with every change of countenance. Even his nostrils and the corners of his mouth, nay, his very ears, moved involuntarily, expressing his hasty transition from eager desire to watchful distrust. There was not, on the contrary, a single feature in his countenance that evinced a consciousness of mental powers or anything that denoted emotions of the mind of a milder species than what belongs to the man in his more mere animal nature. When a piece of meat was given him, and half rising, he stretched out a distrustful arm to take it. He snatched it hastily and stuck it immediately into the fire, peering around with his little keen eyes as if fearing lest someone should take it away again. All this was done with such looks and gestures that anyone must have been ready to swear he had taken an example of them entirely from the ape. He soon took the meat from the embers, wiped it hastily with his right hand upon his left arm, and tore out large half-raw bits with his teeth, which I could see going entirely down his meager throat. The comparisons made between Africans and quadrumana must not be understood as intended to imply human descent from the quadrumana. Entirely apart from the questions of blood relationship, the morphological and the physiognomical resemblance exist, and they are cited for the purpose of showing that just as far as the African diverges from the style of white man, he approximates the lower animals. I have thus far confined myself chiefly to the points of inferiority inherent in Negro and Hottentot personality. Let us turn to history and consider the nature of the results which have proceeded from 4,000 years of Negro existence and activity. We're apprised from the Egyptian monuments that the Negro was in existence at least as early as the 6th dynasty, which according to Lipsius was 2967 B.C. and according to Strong, 20,080 B.C. At that date, his race was numerous enough to be the object of hostile expeditions from Egypt and powerful enough to confer honor upon conquest over him. The Negro race has consequently had national existence in Africa from 4,000 to 5,000 years. What has it accomplished? It has never yet invented an alphabet by which the fugitive vocalizations of its lips could be fixed in a permanent record. It has not preserved one sentence of the history of 4,000 years. It has written neither science, philosophy, nor poetry. It has created neither. It has left us none of the productions of fine art. It has developed only some of the simplest of the useful arts. It has built no cities, erected no durable monuments, excavated no canals, transformed no topography, nor removed any natural obstacles. From the efficient cultivation of the soil, it has organized only the rudest civil societies and has often marked the administration of authority by oppression, cruelty, and bloodshed. What's changed in Africa today? Nothing changes, only they got guns. Now they got cannons. Now they got tanks. Monkeys running around with tanks. It has sold its own blood and flesh into slavery and made a commerce of human merchandise. It has organized no religious associations. Well, that's one thing good. Nor risen generally in the practice of religious worship. No, they're into Christianity. They're into Islam and everything else, which even makes them more weird. Above the grade of dancing, divination, idolatry, and fetichism, it has found no benevolent asylums nor confirmed any charitable associations. Its life has been a continuous scene of personal self-seeking and public administration of the rules of brute force. It has been a struggle to judge of the past from the present, whose constant aim was material comfort and bodily gratification. There have been organized communities and seats of justice and judgment, but these in every instance are the fruits of the Caucasian blood. There have been maternal devotion and filial love, but these, however beautiful and admirable, are only nature's indispensable provisions for the material well-being of the race. It cannot be said that this almost universal backwardness in all individual and social advances based on intelligence is attributable to unfavorable circumstances. You kept us down, white man. The condition of civilization has been favorable. I doubt if it can be shown that any other continental area has been blessed with climate, soil, topography, and other adjuvants equally favorable for human progress. The element ranges from the warm temperature of the north to the warm temperate of the south. It has an equal distribution of the sun's annual heat over the parts lying north and south of central line. No portion of the continent is given over to eternal frost or insufferable seasons. The genial sky spares its populations the forethought, labor, and time of provision against severe and protracted winters. Over most of the continent, rains are adequate in supply and distribution throughout the year. The vast interior, including nearly all south of the Sahara, is an undulating plateau averaging 4,000 to 5,000 feet above the sea level, with numerous mountain ranges attaining 10,000 to 16,000 feet. The tropical climate is therefore fairly attempered to human endurance. Certainly, Negro endurance. Only the Sahara and the Nubian portions suffer from intense heat. The climates are also salubrious, saving portions of the low borders, especially on the west coast. Salt is plentifully distributed, with local exceptions. Copper exists in large quantities in the center of South Africa, and iron is more widely known. Diamonds are abundant in the district of Vaal and the Orange Rivers north of the Cape Colony. Abundance of forest growths cover much of the interior, and farther from the equatorial line, fine parks and pasture lands invite the presence of agriculture and herding. Great rivers drain the continent, which after the passage of the falls, which occurs on the borders of the Great Plateau, furnish navigable channels of communications between all parts of the productive interior. The navigation river and lake system is unsurpassed in extent of any country in the world. The mixed races have utilized these advantages to considerable extent. The delta of the Niger is much more extensive than that of the Nile. The Congo, the Mississippi of Africa, is from 1 to 3 miles in diameter and discharges 2 million cubic feet of water per second. The Great Lakes Victoria and Albert cover each about 30,000 square miles. Many other lakes of fresh water exist, which add to the resources of the interior. In the same manner as the Great Lakes of North America, the considerable elevation of these lakes and the discharge of vast volumes of water must supply to the regions between them and the sea level a surprising amount of water power. The native productions of Africa, suited to the wants of man, are quite numerous. The date palm thrives throughout all the desert regions, wherever a moderate supply of water can be had. It furnishes the bread of the desert and supports not only man, but camel and horse. Wine is produced from the sap south of the Sudan, and baobab, or monkey bread tree, takes place of the date. Here abounds also the oil palm. Other vegetable resources of the continent are the doom palm and the butter tree. There are two native cereals, Negro millet and kaffir corn, which supply farinaceous food. There are also the edible bread roots and earth nuts, which are adequate to supply the daily food of whole villages. Moreover, for thousands of years, the way has been open, as wide as the continent, for the reintroduction of the cereals of Asia. These, indeed, are not entirely unknown to the natives. And maize, the... what is that? Something root. And the sugar cane have been introduced from America to the Europeans and have begun to spread towards the interior. Of course, that's what brought on massive slavery, was the sugar trade, long before the cotton trade. Yeah, and also sort of deteriorated the robust nature of the human person. I mean, you know, that the sugar was bad. The domesticable and useful animals of Africa are not inconsiderable in number. Perhaps the 94 species of Quadruma peculiar to Africa are more noisy and curious than useful. The continent is well stocked with fur-bearing animals whose skins is not needed by the natives would be valuable for export. The quagga and the mountain zebra represent the horse family in the southern parts, while bush hells, zebras, is widely scattered over the plains as far as Abyssinia and the west coast. And the aboriginal wild ass is indigenous to the northeastern Africa. The domestic horse has not been introduced into the intertropical Africa. The single-humped camel, or dromedary, is employed over all North Africa. And the Indian buffalo has also been introduced in the north. Other natives, bovine and ovine species, are extensively distributed, while Africa is the peculiar country of an antelope and a giraffe. Lastly, the African elephant ranges abundantly from the Cape Colony throughout Central Africa, but strange to say, it has never been, like the Indian elephant, domesticated. The only gallinaceous bird is the guinea fowl, but this exists in great abundance, and the partridges and quails are distributed over most parts of the continent. It is pertinent to inquire if such a continent, so outfitted with resources for food, clothing, transportation, intercommunications, and commerce, is a situation suited to cramp the manhood of an indigenous race. Are these the conditions under which the grade of humanity would sink from the level of Adam and Noah to of a naked black skin dribbling in filth and wretchedness on the banks of the Congo or the Zambezi, while under the limnetic vicissitudes of Western Asia and Europe, the same type has risen perpetually through all grades of advances of civilization? The indigenous Africans has nowhere taken more than first steps toward civilization. Some of the tribes have indeed learned the art of productive iron, producing iron, but it is a great wonder that they have not discovered in it the resources of civilization. It has been said that the African elephant is incapable of domestication, but its affinity with the Asiatic species renders the statement incredible. Indeed, the conviction already exists in South Africa that it is equally well adapted for labor, and there can be no doubt would be easily tamed as his Indian elephant. That in this case is amply proved by the docile and submissive state into which both male and female elephants have been brought into zoological gardens and menageries. Nor have any of the equine species been domesticated. Some domesticated animals introduced from Asia are known to the most advanced Africans, but no native species has ever been domesticated. In America, under conditions certainly no more favorable, is a semi-civilization had grown up individually. The only serial native to America is maize, and until the occupation by Europeans, no Asiatic cereal was accepted. The principal edible roots of the America are the manduyasca and the potato, while the feeble llama and vicuña are the only native animals capable of domestication as beasts of burden. I love those potatoes, man. When I was a kid, I was raised a lot on potatoes. I begin to think I was an Irishman. These have been utilized from time immemorial. In the contrast with Africa, the civilization of Nahuatl, nations of Mexico, and the Quiches of Central America, the Mayas of Yucatan, and the Quechaus of Peru had become both in respect to intellectual and industrial advances and judicial, moral, and religious conceptions, almost the stage of true enlightenment. Our wonder in the stationary savagery of virgin Africa is greatly enhanced when we reflected on the relations of civilized people to that continent. Ever since the dawn of a sentient civilization in Western Asia, an open highway to communications has existed between the continents, not to speak of actual communications across the strait from Babrel to Mandeb. More than this, the Asiatic civilization entered Africa and spread itself over the valley of the Nile and the Mediterranean border at a period so remote it's to be obscured by the twilight of human history. It brought with it the cereals and finally the domesticated animals of Asia. It introduced the arts of industry and the rudiments of sciences. It established a religious cult which was monotheistic and remarkably pure and elevated. It opened commercial intercourse, not only with Arabia, Palestine, and Babylonia, but with the tribes of the Upper Nile and the Libyan region. It engaged in an extensive mining operations, not only in the Sinai Peninsula, but in the far southern countries of the Negroes. It worked quarries of limestone and granite on an enormous scale. It tilled the soil in the presence of the most forbidding obstacles to be found in habitable Africa. It sent warlike expeditions not only into Asia Minor and Assyrio-Babylonia, but into the Nubian Ethiopia, and even the armies of the civilized people inevitably sowed the germs of civilization among the barbarians. The Negroes have been in contact with these people for 4,000 years, and save through infusion of blood, they have not yet learned the first lesson in civilization. Are these people whom adverse circumstances have crushed from the grade of the Adamic civilization? Civilability, the forbidden to rise even while the hands of Egypt and Libya and Assyria and Arabia were outstretched to lift them up. The thought is inadmissible. Can aboriginal, deep-seated incapacity is the only explanation for these amazing phenomena. We may further contrast the immobility of the Negroes in conflict with civilization with the facile and eager improvement of the once savage and anthropagus Maoris of New Zealand. The Maoris belong to a type of sometimes distinguished as Polynesian. It is perhaps a hybrid of Malay and the Papuan. They reached their islands about 1400 A.D., and the English took possession in 1769. In 1853, they had made such advancement that the governor, Sir George Grey, reported that both races already form one harmonious community, connected by commercial and agricultural pursuits, possessing the same faith, resorting to the same courts of justice, joining in the same public sports, standing mutually and indifferently to each other, and in the relation of landlord and tenant, and thus insensibly forming one people. Mr. Edward Norris says they now vie with Englishmen in many of their pursuits. They are expert riders and breeders of horses. They understand perfectly how to make a bargain. They erect buildings, cultivate land, and form good roads for far beyond the limits of the English settlements. The more opulent among them become ship owners, landlords, and millers, the latter being especially a favorite occupation. The poorer people make roads, till the ground, tend to cattle, build houses and ships, fish for whales, and navigate ships generally. According to a good authority, the most regular, clean, and orderly of all the coasting vessels plying between Auckland and the Bay of Islands is owned and named wholly by natives, and is preferred by the public as a conveyance for passengers before all others. They resort readily to the English law courts, becoming even annoyingly litigious, and their favorite conversation is said to be religious and political discussion and the general news of the day. Yet even the Maoris are described as quite inferior intellectually to Englishmen. I need only refer to the familiar history of Sandwich Islands to further enforce the significance of the comparison. In fact, all Polynesia is fairly represented by these examples. It would be proper to raise the question whether the Negro is capable of appreciating, desiring, and conserving the benefits of civilization. The inertia of the Negro in a state of servitude, his scarcely improved condition, and certain diminution in numbers since enfranchisement in the United States, his political and social career of Haiti, his massacre of the agents and destruction of the agencies of civilization in St. Thomas, his helplessly subordinate nation station in the northern states of our Union and in Canada, his indifference to the benefits of civilization in Liberia, the persistent vitality of Voodooism among American Negroes, and the close environment of a high civilization and the Negroes' facile relapses, as in the Congo, into a state of subject barbarism as soon as the props of foreign aid are removed, consistent a set of facts for grave reflection. If the Negro is constitutionally incapable of availing himself of Caucasian civilization, how many lives shall we sacrifice, and how many millions shall we lavish in attempts to foist it upon him? I hope I shall not be set down as unfriendly to the Negro. Should any person deem me so, I extend to him all the pity deserved by ignorance and error. I shall not feel hurt. I have no special occasion for unfriendliness towards the Negro. The world would be better if he were an efficient factor in enlightened humanity. The country would be better if he were an elevating and progressive influence instead of a depressing and barbarizing one. I should like to see him capable of coping with his white rival, or at least profiting from his example and aid. I will do all possible to make him so. Well, that's a waste of time. But the work must be prosecuted with a clear view to the facts. We defeat the end by proceeding blindfold. I'm not responsible for the inferiority which I discovered existing. I'm only contemplating a range of facts that seems to prove such inferiority. I am responsible if I ignore the facts and teach their teaching and act toward the Negro as if he were capable of all the responsibilities of the white race. I am responsible if I grant him privileges which he can only pervert to his detriment and mine, or impose upon him duties which he is incompetent to perform or given to understand. The similar inferiority of the other black races, it would not be difficult to prove. The measurements already given show the Australian to possess an organism quite inferior to that of the Negro. In intelligence, he is said to be so low as to be unable to count over 4 or 5. Of the Actus of the Philippines, De La Geronius says that they gave him the impression of being a great family of monkeys. Their voices recalled the short cry of these animals, and their movements strengthened the analogy. Buechner says that the toes of these savages, who live partly in grottos, partly on trees, are very mobile and more separated than ours, especially the great toe. They use them in maintaining themselves on branches and cords, as with fingers. According to Buechner, the language of the savage of Borneo is rather a kind of warbling or croaking than a truly human mode of expression, unquote. The Vedas of Ceylon, says Sir Emerson Tennant, communicate among themselves almost entirely by means of signs, grimaces, guttural sounds resembling very little true words or true language. Well, that sounds like niggers in Chicago. The Dokos of Abyssinia, according to Crap, are human pygmies. They are not more than 4 feet high, and their skin is of an olive brown. The wanderers in the woods, they live like animals without habitations, without sacred trees, and so on. They go naked, nourishing themselves by roots, fruit, mice, serpents, ants, honey. They climb trees like monkeys. Without chief, without law, without arms, without marriage, they have no family and mate by chance like animals. They also multiply rapidly. The mother, after a very short lactation, abandons her child to itself. They neither hunt nor cultivate nor sow, and they never have been known to use fire. They have thick lips, a flattened nose, little eyes, long hair, hands and feet, with the great nails with which they dig in the soil. I saw a couple of those guys the other day. Some of the American tribes remain at the lowest point of degradation. This is the case of the Fuegians, F-U-E. You know, I think that was the basis that they accused Abraham Lincoln of being from that sub-race. F-U-E-G-I-A-N-A. I can't quite read this. And the Botucas of Brazil have been often cited. Of the latter, Lalaman says, quote, "I'm sadly convinced that they are monkeys with two hands," unquote. In the presence of a body of facts like those edited to the same chapter, it seems impossible to doubt that the nature has established a wide range of gradations among the races, which cannot be obliterated by any influence having less than secular duration. It seems beyond all rational question that the Aboriginal of Africa are vastly inferior to the Mediterranean race, and that consequently, if they and other black races are posterity of nature, the world races The world has witnessed a general scene of degradation and retrogression, which almost reflects an infinite wisdom and benefits. And that's the end of that pamphlet. And that was written by Alexander Winchell, same spelling as Walter Winchell. Of course, all of what this all means is we have to be straight honest racing, and they can yell and say they got no new scientific proof and everything else. But the only thing that has biologically lifted up the Negro at all is race mixing. And, of course, it'll never raise him to the point where he would like to be. But and our enemies use it as a main plank of their destruction of the white race. It's absolutely the number one weapon in their arsenal, has been race mixing for a long time, and now it's in total super high gear. And if you don't recognize it and talk about it and attempt to do something about it over the long haul, you have no chance. You have no chance.
In other words, boys, you're screwed.
So go to all your liberal friends and all those people and say,
"Did you hear what Tommy said, that terrible Tommy? God, he's the most crazy racist I ever heard." Give it to him, baby. Give it to him.
George, charge out the jungle, strong as he can be. Watch out for that tree. George, charge out the jungle, lives a life that's free. Watch out for that tree. When he gets in a scrape, he makes his escape with help from his friend, an ape named Dave. And his elephant chef can fetch along his man's best friend, he's George's dog. He's George of the jungle, strong as he can be. Watch out for that tree. Holler, swing and sing, all the animals come to the jungle king.
George of the jungle, George of the jungle.
So grab a vine and swing in time, and smack a tree, just pay no mind. Like George of the jungle, strong as he can be.